Hey everybody, Nate here. Before the show, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about our sponsor, the Snack Nanny. The Snack Nanny is the latest, greatest spill-proof bowl. It's the first snack bowl for kids with a self-closing door. The Snack Nanny allows kids to snack freely without overeating, keeps kids entertained, and prevents them from creating a mess for mom and dad to clean up. Kids and parents love the Snack Nanny. It's easy to use, easy to clean, and includes portion control features that only the Snack Nanny offers. To order, go to www.snacknanny.com. or order from Amazon. Remember, you support our sponsors and they support us. Thanks, and Nihei Debiru. Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks. Hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Chop Talk. This is your host, Nate England. Today's episode, I continue my road trip to Nashville to work out at James McLean's Kosho School of Karate. The episode picks up just as Richard Garrett and I are pulling into town. Richard talks about the country music scene in Nashville and his own efforts to write and market country music. I had a chance to listen to some of his songs, and they're great. I'm sure you'll be hearing them on the radio soon. But since they're in the process of marketing the songs, we couldn't include them in the show. However, Richard and his writing partners were nice enough to let us use the instrumentals as the bumper music, which you've been hearing in the show for the last few weeks. Richard shares a few more stories about his teacher, James McLean, and at the end of the episode, he talks about his work at the Nashville Children's Hospital. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show. All right, time for the on-the-road portion of the show. So we're with Richard Garrett. Rest stop in between Cincinnati and Nashville.
Yes, we are. I just got a text message from Mr. Scott here.
Yeah?
With one of my favorite Sensei Awad isms.
What's that?
You're on your own for breakfast!
You're on your own! For breakfast!
You're on your own for breakfast. Back in the land of the yokels.
That's what I told you guys whenever you come up to work out in Cincinnati, right?
Yeah. You're gonna come over to my house. We're gonna cook a bunch of Mets. We'll hang out. We'll drink beer. You guys can stay at the house next door. It'll be great. We'll go work out at the dojo. Tomorrow morning, you guys are on your own for breakfast. That's been a running joke for, I guess, probably 6 or 7 years now.
Right.
It's kind of a funny thing that's stuck around in the group conscience of the karate dojo here in Nashville.
So, Richard, why don't you talk about a little bit about your budding music career? What's going on with that?
Me and one of my buddies, Josh Grimm, I actually met him, well, through a handful of, you know, kind of a group of friends, but Ezra and Josh have worked together doing landscaping work and things like that for quite a while now. And Josh is a great musician. Much better guitar player than me, and we decided we were going to get together and try to write some, like, pop country, marketable country songs, you know?
All right.
To pitch, not for either one of us to really make it as performers ourselves, but try to pitch and, you know, get the Tim McGraws and Kenny Chesney type people about 10 songs together.
Okay.
We got our, you know, kind of filtered through them and got our best, you know, 4 or 5 songs, and recorded those at my buddy Dave Coleman's house. He's got a band called Coleman.
And, okay.
And he's got a home studio. We recorded some demos over at his house. We had a handful of different people sing on and things like that.
Well, you guys are in the place to do it. I mean, Nashville's the heart of country music, right? So all the big singers, that's where they're going to go, all the up-and-comers are going to go there to try to get some publicity, you know, get out and be heard, and all the big-time people, that's still where they're going to get all their songs and do all their producing, right?
Yeah, that's where all the business side is, especially of country music, but it's becoming more and more. There's a lot of rock and roll and things like that in Nashville, too. It's a pretty big, like, hip-hop and rap scene also, but...
You're gonna write some rap songs next?
I don't think so. I think we'll stay away from that. Josh and I are more kind of rock and roll or blues, R&B kind of guys ourselves anyway. But yeah, we just kind of set out. We're like, let's try to write, you know, pop country music. Let's see what we can do.
And they sound really good. You played some for me a little earlier in the car ride, and they're great. It's exactly the kind of stuff that you hear on the radio. And I never knew you were a music guy before this, but you played a little bit of the guitar and even did the vocals on one of them, right?
Yeah, that's the thing, you know, I mean, people are like, oh, you can play guitar. It's like, well, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, you know, like,
okay.
It's kind of,
all right.
It's kind of like if you're from wherever, you know, out in the country in Texas, like, oh, you can ride a horse? Like, yeah, I can ride a horse.
Who could?
Everybody can ride a horse.
It'd be more unusual if you couldn't play the guitar.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, so, I got you.
Well, yeah, but my dad's a great guitar player, a really good singer. I'd started messing around playing guitar, I guess, you know, I was 10, 12 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of think about it. You know, I've been playing guitar and fooling around with stuff like that for 20 years now. I don't consider myself a real hotshot guitar player, but I can play guitar pretty good.
Yeah, well, it definitely sounded like it.
Yeah.
So now the next step is to try to get some ears on it from either some of the big time names that people heard about or the producers, and try to get it sold, right?
Yeah. The weird thing is all that stuff goes through people that pitch songs.
Okay.
To producers and record labels. Those record labels, they don't take unsolicited material. You can't just pop into their office and be like, here, listen to this tape.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, let me play you a song on my guitar. But, you know, they're not into that. There's too...
So it's not like the 80s where you dropped off a mixtape and a bag of cocaine and all of a sudden it was on the radio.
No, you usually have to go get a body of songs, meaning, you know, most of those publishing companies aren't even going to pay attention to you until you've probably got, you know, well over 100 songs.
Okay.
And then if they want to, they'll demo them and all this sort of stuff, and they'll kind of sign you to a publishing deal. The thing with that is if anybody ever makes any money off of it, they take half.
Okay.
And they're the ones that hire the guys that pitch the songs to the producers and record labels and such. And there aren't a whole lot of those people that pitch those songs in Nashville. You know, if I had to guess, I'd say there's maybe, you know, a dozen or 20 people that have that kind of access. And if they think your song sucks, they're not going to pitch it, because if they start pitching all these songs that aren't any good, then all of a sudden they won't have the access that they once had.
Okay.
You know, they won't have the audience, per se, of those type of people. So it's a really interesting deal.
And you're telling me something really interesting about the way that the royalties work in country music compared to rock or rap, where with the country artists don't always or don't primarily write their own songs, where it's a lot of the rock musicians or rap or R&B, they'll usually write their songs.
Yeah, a lot of the, you know, rap. rock and roll, stuff like that, that those bands or people write their own songs, make their own albums with top 40 pop music and top 40 country. Almost none of that is written by the artists.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the real opportunity is. You know, you got these 50, 60-year-old guys, and or whatever, any age, but you got these 50 or 60-year-old guys writing songs that get sung by the 20-something stars, you know?
Uh-huh.
And they're just these dudes that, like, hang out in coffee shops and whatever. I grew up with a bunch of them. This one guy, his name's Pat Alger. He wrote... Him and his buddy, Tony, wrote the majority of all the Garth Brooks hits in the 90s.
Wow.
Huge country hits. And Pat was one of my friend's dads and would, like, come and keep stats at the Little League baseball games and stuff like that. So, you know, it's just these really kind of normal guys that live these, you know, somewhat middle-class lives. You know, and you wouldn't know who the hell they were unless you really were into knowing who all the writers were in Nashville. You know?
Right.
Most really kind of under the radar sort of career.
Most people just know the stars, and that's where it is.
And guys like that will play out and kind of play these writers' nights and stuff like that, but they're not in the limelight, you know. But they live in nice houses and in nice neighborhoods and make nice livings doing it.
So how do they get paid for the songs? Garth Brooks decides he likes this guy's song and he cuts him a check for a few thousand dollars, or it gets the royalties? How does it normally work?
So much of that stuff is in limbo now. When record sales used to be, you know, predominantly how music was distributed, uh-huh. You know, people buying CDs. Whatever format of music. Now so much is just sold directly straight on iTunes, you know, and things like that. But so when you're talking about people, they call it terrestrial radio, you know, the radio stations on regular dials. Those radio spins is how you get your money.
Okay.
And I was talking earlier about, you know, Tim McGraw or whoever, when their top 10 hit is on the radio 20 times a day on one radio station in whatever city, Tim McGraw doesn't get any money from that. I don't know all the specifics
of
that.
Wow, okay.
But he doesn't get any money from that. Who gets the money from that is the publishing and writing.
Okay.
And it's kind of justified in the sense that, well, Tim McGraw is getting this free publicity from us so that when he plays whatever arena or whatever and is making these big checks touring on the road,
he
gets money.
All the people are hearing his song, hearing his name. When he comes to town, they buy a ticket to his show, and that's where he makes his money.
And, of course, he's got, you know, record deals with, you know, the big name kind of record companies. You know, they're paying him a lump sum to make these records.
Sure.
You know, kind of,
sure.
And they're kind of betting that he's going to have some top 10 hits and this and that, whatever. But the people that make money off of radio spins is predominantly the writing, you know, publishing end of it, not the performers.
Okay.
Now, if he was to write a song, then he would get that. But like I said, you know, predominantly in those, in pop music and pop country, the majority of that stuff is written by third parties.
Hmm.
It's an interesting thing. And I think that's the kind of thing, too. I mean, you know, growing up around Nashville, you know, I've just always kind of just thought that I didn't want any part of that sort of stuff. Grown up knowing a lot of people in their family and such, you know, people, you know, really of big influence in the music business. And I always just thought it was kind of hammy or whatever and didn't want a whole lot of part of it. But yeah, about a year ago, we sat down and we just kind of decided, let's try to do it. Let's see what we can come up with.
Yeah.
And we did it and we cut some demos, and they're pretty good. I mean, you know,
they are.
The kind of software and things that they've got now in terms of recording equipment. You know, I mean, it, not that it's not, you know, a pretty good investment for somebody to outfit their basement or something like that with a home studio and Pro Tools and such. You know, to, but it's not a, you don't have to have a $500,000 studio to make a decent demo.
No, well, I found that with the podcast is, you know, I've got a laptop and I have, I downloaded a free copy of Audacity. A microphone to do, you know, some of the intros and outros, and you're in business all of a sudden.
Yeah.
With the music, obviously, you need a little bit more, because you have to have the higher quality microphones and to get all the instruments. But it's really doable for someone to do in their home for a reasonable amount of money now.
And that's the, you know, that's a really great part about it, and. Then at the same time, it makes it so any joker can do it.
Right.
And so anybody that's even halfway legit and trying to do something that's really, you know, just get kind of lost in this sea. You know, we're just all so inundated with that sort of stuff. I mean, same thing with martial arts. You know, type in Shuto Strike on YouTube and you just see a thousand things pop up. You know, and maybe 15 of them are from somebody that, you know, is that really warrants attention.
Right.
But, you know, you can't, it's so hard to filter through all that stuff and try to figure out something like that. That's just an example, whatever. But,
sure.
You know, so that's a good and bad part about, you know, the sort of technology that's going on now in terms of social media and accessibility.
So the question is finding out if, when you do have a good product, and you guys definitely do, you know, trying to step out in front of that crowd of, and you know, separate yourselves from every other idiot with a Casio and a microphone.
Yeah.
And getting some beers on it. But I think you guys will make it. You know, hopefully those in between guys will like it, and you'll be hearing it on the radio pretty soon.
Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks.
Kind of some of the thing with recording some of this stuff, you know, They're really good. Yeah, they just kind of recorded it. Yeah, man, I don't know. Like, the vocals on this, I'm not so sure that I'm happy with that. And that's, you know, I'll see, like, a video of myself. I'll run a kata or something. I think I'm looking real sharp or whatever. And I'll see the video. I'm like, I'm not looking as sharp as I think I look in my own mind.
Right. Well, you know? Well, you're always your own worst critic, too. And you're looking for every little thing that you did wrong. Or maybe you thought you slipped or lost your balance or missed that note at a certain point. And then maybe if you listen to that tape, maybe it was only in your own mind where you missed it. Nobody else watching you knew it.
It's a difficult thing. But it's just like, you know, it's just self-expression and stuff. You know, it's things that you find in your life that, you know, are worth pursuing or at least putting some energy into. You know, you got to be fairly committed to things like that to have it be worthwhile at all. Mr. Scott Ezra, he talks about that a lot, you know, especially about martial arts, you know, related to a lot of things. Like, you know, you're only going to get out of this what you put into.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and that's how, and he's been talking with me more about that, about trying to train more, you know.
Yeah.
And I've heard a really awesome interview that I found online. It's through the USKK website, and it was an interview that somebody had conducted with Master Keppel, and he kind of mentioned that in there, you know, that that one of his biggest regrets was is that, you know, in the 70s, 80s, or early 90s, that he wish he would have spent more time training, you know, when he was younger.
Yeah.
And kind of quoted one of his martial arts friends of like, the only way that you get better at martial arts is training. There is no...
Really? You mean you can't watch Bruce Lee movies?
Well, you and I were talking about that earlier, you know, the kind of chat groups that are...
You can't talk about it online and run everybody else down?
Blogs, Facebooks and stuff, there's so much sniping.
You can't declare that you're the greatest martial artist who ever lived and everybody believes you?
What's the...
Oh, no.
And there's a time and a place for it, sure, but the over-intellectualization, you know, it's like becoming so intellectualized about how to do a shuto strike, and it's like, why don't you go out there and shuto strike the heavy bag for an hour, you know, like, you'll be better at that than you were when you started, that sort of stuff. You get into that, Sensei McClain talked about that too, he said, you get into all that stuff, it just drives you crazy. Or like, what is the only true form of martial arts and the root of everything or something, you know, and just turns into a goose chase.
Right.
You know? I do feel really lucky to have kind of ended up working out at Sensei McClain's dojo, you know, for that reason. You know, because it seems like, you know, the best you can do is just hope that there's people that are near enough to you that you can actually, you know, work out with them on a regular basis.
Right.
You know, that really are, you know, pretty good and, you know, dedicated to teaching and
serious about what they're doing.
And still train and stuff, you know.
Well, and that's something that... if you're interested in martial arts, you have to, you know, look and see what is around you and not necessarily go to the whatever dojo's down the street, because maybe you'll luck out. Maybe that guy is a, you know, a world-class martial artist, or maybe it's just some guy who promoted himself to black belt and created his own style, and now he's a great grandmaster of Chi Kung Fu, and he doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. So you gotta take a look at it. Now, of course, if you live in a place like Okinawa or Tokyo, or some other place like that, sure, there's a karate master on every corner, and they really know what they're doing. There's really high concentration. But in the U.S., they're a little more spread out. So you might have two or three really good people in a town, and then you have to go to the next city over to find the next two or three instead of the next block over, like you might in, like I said, in Naha or Kyoto, something like that.
I get the sense that in Okinawa that there's more mutual respect between styles and dojos and stuff. I don't know if that's true or not.
No. There's more political shit going on in there than any other place. Wow. And there is just
there's plenty of it here.
Yeah, there's more of it there. And it's amazing how. Now, you and I come from a little different spot than a lot of people because how we came up, our teachers, you know, Shion Walker and Sensei McLean, you know, were open to looking at other types of martial arts and do something about it and would read about it and try to work out with other people. But a lot of other ones didn't. And in Okinawa, a lot of times they didn't. There were some people who did, but other times, you know, if you're growing up and there's a Goju dojo as your one next door neighbor and a Shoremaru dojo as your other next door neighbor, you know, you pick which dojo you're going to go to, and you never walked in the other one for the rest of your life. So there is a lot of people there that are really still do have the blinders on and aren't interested in the other martial arts.
Yeah, I think that's too bad. Far from town now, we're pulling up in the north side of Nashville. This is where people will try to kill you.
Oh, Hickory Boulevard.
You gotta practice your karate on these interstates. Okay. You gotta hear all things and see in all directions. Yeah, we'll be getting out. We're gonna go to my house.
All right, and then the dojo.
And then we're going to the dojo. And we're going to work out with Mr. Scott and Mr. Stinson. I don't think Mr. Tillman, he's not going to make it, but he'll make it
tomorrow
morning.
All right.
But the four of us will work out. Maybe Sensei will come out there for a while.
Nice.
Check us out.
Tell us what we're doing right or more likely wrong.
Mr. Scott, Ezra's really, you know, kept that dojo together over the last handful of years.
With all of Mr. McLean's health problems.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, he really assumed the responsibility of primarily teaching classes and such, you know, probably 5 years ago. These are all estimations.
Right.
You know, he's really been running class and stuff. I've learned a lot of martial arts from him.
Yeah, he's a good karate guy.
It's been interesting too, because, you know, some of the stuff I was talking about yesterday in the coffee shop you know, he's so much bigger than me. It's such a different build, and I'm in there, I'm trying to spar with him and such. But he's good at seeing, you know, what works for me. You know, how something is or is not going to work for me. And, you know, how things that will work for me or someone like Sensei McLean, you know, won't work for him. That's a big thing, you know.
So adapting what you're doing to your own body.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sensei McLean really was one of the first and primary teachers of all the Awad brothers, but they're all such different builds than he is that their own stylistic, you know, types of karate really look different. You know,
right.
Even if in theory there's a lot of the same ideas, but you know, you can really see the differences in how that is. But you know, Sensei McLean, you know, I mean, I was talking to him about Sensei Awad Mike. You know, he was just like, oh man, he's like, Mike's Mike's got awesome technique, you know. But they do totally different karate. That's because Mike Awad is 6 inches taller than Sensei McLean and 100 pounds heavier.
Right.
You know. So it's different. And that's kind of how some of that is with myself.
Except in reverse. Now we're taking it from the big guy back to the little guy. Yeah.
So I try to channel some sensei stuff. I keep hoping that it'll give me some sort of secrets. He'll get there every once in a while. He'll be like, "Oh yeah, what you got to do? You get in there and do this." Get in there and waffle. He says that a lot though. He said, "Yeah, you just get in there and just knock the hell out of him. Don't worry about all that other stuff." He takes some of that stuff with a grain of salt, the real high-end, theoretical karate.
More esoteric side.
I told you about that. He said, "Oh, yeah, there's a dragon." He said, "Oh, yeah, I call that the buffalo."
The dragon fist. Yeah, the buffalo fist.
That's like, why you call it a buffalo sensei? He said, "Because there ain't no such thing as a dragon."
Looking for great entertainment? Want to find the best deals on food and drinks? Use the PubPal app to find great establishments near you. View daily specials, find live bands, karaoke, even poetry. If you're looking for something to do, PubPal is the answer, and it's only a click away. Download the app on the Apple Store and get the Android app on Google Play. And don't forget to like them on Facebook. Visit PubPalUSA.com to find out more. That's PubPalUSA. PubPalUSA.
Speaking of like the Mr. Awadisms, the Sensei McLeanisms, he'll come out there and he'll teach some sort of wrist lock thing or something like that, a little more intricate trapping and this and that. Mm-hmm. And then he'll kind of look at all of us and be like, "Well, you really need to practice that a lot, and you need to know how to do that." He said, "You try to do something like that, guy built like a Coke machine, he's liable to take that karate and shove it right up your ass." So that's some of the, you know, the realism.
And, right.
And he really, I talked with him before about, you know, 10-year-old kids that are real high ranked, third, fourth, fifth, dons. You know, it's just, thinks that that's kind of like brainwashing those children into thinking that there's some sort of supernatural thing about what's going on, you know. You know, that Sensei and Master Keppel and Master Trius, you know, all of them, that was really like kind of a first generation thing. You know, martial arts really seemed to be, you know, something that really broke color barriers, you know, in the, like, early 60s, you know. This is way pre-Woodstock. This is like 1964, right. You know, I mean, this is in the real thick of the civil rights movement and stuff, and, you know, and I know from Sensei McLean's like, "Hey, I don't care if somebody's black or gay or anything, you know, whatever, if you want to work out and train, I'll teach you, you know." You know, those guys have all been in a lot of fist fights.
Yeah.
Karate or no karate, right. You know.
Right.
All karate aside, all of them guys have been in a lot of fist fights. And that really counts for something, you know.
Well, speaking of the 10-year-old black belts, you helped out teaching the kids class this week when you were down in Cincinnati. Shoot. And helped out a lot.
That was tough.
But you're good with the kids. You're good with the kids. Hey, so you work in the children's hospital, right?
Yeah, I work at the children's hospital here in Nashville in the emergency room. You see some wild stuff.
I'll bet. I spent a little time at a children's hospital myself. I was in there for about 2 months when I was 12 and 13 years old.
Yeah, you told me you had a septic hip.
Yeah, I had a septic hip. And and had a real bad fever. They call it septic arthritis. Staph infection was in there and almost died but didn't. But I think I set the record for longest stay in the children's hospital. So I was proud about that. I'm going to do it.
I don't know if that's to be happy.
If I'm going to, well, I wasn't happy about it, but if I'm going to do it, I'm going to be number one, damn it.
Here we are. We're pulling into my neighborhood now.
All right.
I started living over here about 10 years ago, and this was a real rough place. There were people selling dope and selling themselves.
And you moved in and
robbing and stealing. And
you moved in and cleaned them up.
Yeah, I don't know that I had anything to do with it, but it's cleaned up considerably. Nashville's really grown a lot. See, I told you you got to use your karate around here. I always wanted to make that little building right there a little karate dojo.
Oh, that'd be a good little dojo, yeah.
Little karate dojo. Best karate is learned in small spaces. Since they talk about that stuff, you know, if three guys want to jerk you up and beat you up in a bathroom or something, what are you going to do? You going to jump up in the air and do all this crazy spin wheel kick and, you know, and all this kind of stuff? So, no, you need to know how to block or punch and punch them. You know, simple as that. Not a whole lot of magic to it. Here we are. We're up to my spot now here at the end of the alley.
All right.
It's been a really great trip up and back. I've had a really fun time being with you and getting to work out at the school in Cincinnati and such. So.
Yeah, it's been a real good road trip.
And that's all for today's show. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks.